This podcast is certified Rob Safe.
Yeah! This is Brad Carter from PLA Radio, and you're listening to Mikey Pod.
Mikey Pod. Hello, this is October 2nd, 2006. Welcome to Mikey Pod. This is episode number 68. And as I promised yesterday, here is Ellie Castle, a community member here at Koinonia Farm in Americus, Georgia, telling us the history of how the farm got started by Clarence Jordan and company. I wanted to do this little intro here to let you know that the obnoxious static noises you're going to hear in the beginning go away. And I toned them down as much as I could. Yes, they're obnoxious. And yes, I apologize. But I didn't want to leave any of it out. So it's only aggravating for a few seconds in the beginning there. So just be patient and it will go away. Now, enjoy the fascinating beginnings of Koinonia Farm. I'm here with Ellie Castle, who is a community member here at Koinonia, and she's going to talk to us some about, well, first, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Mikey. What fun.
We're set up in the duplex, which is the room where I'm staying, and we have one mic on a stand, and we're swinging it back and forth, which is kind of a funny little setup. So, let's talk about maybe just the beginnings of Koinonia.
Well, Koinonia is a 600-acre farm in southwest Georgia, outside Americus. It's a Christian intentional community. It was started in 1942 by a man named Clarence Jordan. He was quite an unusual character, even from boyhood. He was raised in southwest Georgia, one of four sons of the local banker and store owner. So he grew up in an all-white society in a very segregated county. But in the beginning, somehow he had the idea that there was something kind of wrong with this whole system of segregation, that his life was all among whites and the blacks were all together and didn't interact. In Sunday school, they used to sing the song, you know, Jesus loves the little children, red, yellow, black, and white. They are precious in his sight. And he thought, gee, they don't seem too precious because they're always so poor and so, you know, discounted. Now nobody else seemed to worry about that. They sang that song without any trouble, I guess. And if they did, I think, question it, it probably was, well, that's just the way it is. One thing that was significant in his young life was that they lived next to the prison. And he would stop on the way coming and going to school and talk to some of the prisoners that were out on detail. He found them really interesting. He said, more interesting than some of the people in his Baptist church. But what really got to him was that he could hear them torturing prisoners. This would have been in the 20s, 30s. They were still stringing people up by their thumbs and stretching them, beating them. And these were mostly black prisoners, and they were all white guards. And all of a sudden it occurred to him that these white guards that were torturing these people were members of his church. Again, nobody else in his family had any interest in this, probably not many of his acquaintances. As he kept growing up, he kept observing that most of the blacks were sharecroppers. This was in, the 20s and 30s. And so the sharecropping system, you know, Mike, it was just, you were stuck in poverty. You were always in debt because you had to borrow everything from the master, and then you never had enough to pay it back. And so he thought, what could you do to help these people get out of this cycle of poverty? And so that's why he chose to go to the University of Georgia and get his degree in agriculture. Think, maybe I can do something to help these poor sharecroppers. Following his graduation from Georgia, he went to seminary at the Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville. And here he had another experience of the plight of the blacks. And he worked as his field work in the inner city of Louisville. And these people, he could see that the blacks had migrated up from the southern part of Georgia, and because they couldn't make a living, but they couldn't make a living in the city either because they had no skills, and they were actually more miserable. They were poor and in their own home. Here they were poor in a strange city. So again, he thought, if I could just do something to help these people make a living so they don't have to leave home, that kind of confirmed his idea that he would get a farm. At the same time this is going on, he becomes interested in the idea of a Christian community. He, of all people, probably most of us have ever known, really believed in taking Jesus' teaching seriously. You really ought to live like he said you ought to live. And so he said, well, if we're trying to figure out what that is, who would you look to? And he said, well, probably the first disciples, the people that were closest to Jesus in time. And so he, in the book of Acts, in the second chapter, it talks about the disciples living together in community, pooling all their possessions, and then giving out according to need. So he thought, that sounds like the proper pattern for a Christian community. So he put those kind of two ideas together and said, I will go back down to South Georgia and look for a farm and establish a farm community. And that's what he did. Looked all around and didn't find anything that just seemed right. And he was just about to buy a farm in Alabama when his brother said, there's a farm, it's just all run down in Sumter County, Georgia. I want you to come and look at that. And so he says that as soon as he set foot on this farm, he knew that was the place that God wanted the community to be. A man had offered to make a down payment on the farm. He was interested in this experiment. And the farm was so run down and so cheap that he paid for about all of it. So that was another signal that this must be God's will. And so in November of 1942, he and another couple, Martin and the Englands, came without any machinery. I think they had a total of like $35 between them, something like that. Certainly it wasn't, this is an act of faith, with the idea that they were going to work with their poor black neighbors. A couple of things about this that I think were unique and very significant from the beginning was, first of all, he had this degree in agriculture, and he could have come in and said, now, I see your chickens look pretty skinny and they're pecking around in your yard. That if you would just feed your chickens this way or build them a chicken house, you know, you could have better chickens and better eggs. No, he did not do that. He waited. He started having his own chickens and really built up quite a large chicken and egg business and would wait for them to say, gee, how do you get such big eggs or such nice fat chickens? And he'd say, hey, we'll work on this together. Let's look at what we need to do, and would help them find a ration or build the brooder house together. So from the beginning, it wasn't, I have this information you need. You're not doing it right. But respected they had the experience. He had never actually farmed in his life. He just had book knowledge. And so he really needed their experience. In fact, he talks about, well, I don't know this is how true this is, but that they would get up on the roof of the barn in the morning, look out and see what their neighbors were doing. If they're planting peanuts, they'd plant peanuts. If it's time to harvest the corn, they'd harvest the corn. So it was a neat combination of experience and knowledge that proved then to be a partnership. Always he worked with people in a partnership. I'm not here to do something to you, for you, because you can't, you know, do it yourself, but that together we could really make good things happen. And so our name comes from the idea of that idea of partnership, working together, and also from the fact that Jesus invited his disciples to be his partners, not his slaves. The other thing that was really cool about the beginning, I think, was that everybody had to give up all of their possessions when they came to Koinonia. You couldn't bring them to Koinonia and give them to Koinonia. That would mean you might have more power than somebody that hadn't brought as much money. You gave it all away before. That would be investments, property, everything. So you came with nothing, so your dependency was totally on the community and God, and trusting in God's providing. Now, what this did for the neighbors was, it was like, gee, these guys aren't putting on any airs. They got these old rattle-trap pickup trucks. They are pulling the plow themselves because they have no machinery or animals. I mean, what is with these white people who usually don't behave this way? And so from the, I think, again, from the beginning, it was like there wasn't this big gulf, economic gulf, of the rich coming to help the poor. It was like we're divesting ourselves. We are poor. We are sharing. And the whole idea, actually, of the Greek word koinonia is holding things in common and sharing in a deep fellowship. And so his wife Florence, who came with him, by the way, says that was the whole idea, that some people have more than they need, some people don't have enough, and so you ought to be sharing. It ought to be somehow more equal than it seemed to be, especially in Southwest rural poor Georgia, but probably that's true anywhere. today, even today. But I think that helped to make people feel, the neighbors to feel at home. At the same time, he just was always, just saw people for their needs. He never saw, never asked questions about why they needed it or what they were going to do about it. It was just like, come on in, you know, y'all come. I would say that was his philosophy, is y'all come. And so it would be time for lunch, and he'd say, okay, let's stop for lunch and come on in and have a bite. And they'd say, you know, you mean in the dining room? Yeah. With you? Yeah. We don't eat with whites, says the blacks, you know. And he would say, oh, come on, you know, that didn't matter. He'd say, don't go around the back door, just come on in the front. Well, you didn't do that either in those days. And so it was sort of like the blacks are saying, whoa, this guy is different. Like, in fact, I think it probably took them a little while to trust him. It was like, is he for real? Yeah. Of course, the whites are saying, he's a Georgia boy. He ought to know better. What is he doing? Breaking all these traditions that we have built up and counted on as being forever, you know. So those three things, I think, gave an element of generosity, of compassion, of concern, of equality to the farm and its neighbors from the very beginning. As you can guess, things didn't get too popular with the whites. They would just, at the beginning, they would just say, well, you know, they're eating out there together. You know, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. He started picking up the black kids to take them to school. And because they had to walk. The whites had a bus, but the blacks had to walk. And from Koinonia area, it was like 5 miles to the nearest school. And so he just said, hop in my station wagon, you know, and I'll take you to school. And the people are saying, we don't want them niggers educated. What are you doing taking them to school? So education, a lot of things revolved around about educating the blacks, because once they became capable, you know, they could maybe become what they might consider a threat. Actually, he actually got a bus also, got them to give him an old, beat-up, thrown-away white bus to take the children to school. I think it's... quite something. The story goes that they painted the fenders and the bumpers black. I presume so that they would know that this is the black bus. You don't get on this bus. Yeah. And somebody said to me, well, the driver wouldn't have let him on the bus anyway. I mean, it was really just a way of saying, you know, this is an inferior bus for inferior people, and made that kind of a statement. Indication that maybe people were really watching what was happening at Koinonia and criticizing it was when it was during a summer camp. But they would have interracial summer camps, and they would go around in the neighborhood and pick up all the kids and bring them in for vacation Bible school. Well, whites found out about that, they got an injunction saying that they could not have the camp. And that was overturned, and so then they had to figure out something else. And so finally they ended up accusing Koinonia of teaching the children bad morals, because they might see some baby pigs born, and that would just that wouldn't of course I'm sure there were white farms having baby pigs too, but that was what they kind of made up. It got so vicious, kind of, that they did cancel the school, the vacation Bible school locally, and they held it up in Tennessee at a sister community, Highlander School. There was a woman not long ago came by who was a child that was in that group. And she said something that just startled me, that they took the children up to Tennessee in the farm truck, in the back of the farm truck. And every time they would go through a town of any size, especially in Atlanta, they would put a tarp over the top of the truck so that nobody could see who was in the back of the truck. Because if they had seen that there were black and white children back there together, there would have probably been trouble. Wow. So it's just the beginning of a of an indication that, whoa, people don't like this, and they will try to stop it.
And this was still in the 40s when this was brand new sort of thought, right?
This would be in the late 40s and very early 50s. Several other things happened that made people think, wondered about them too. One was that Clarence was asked to sponsor the first black at the University of Georgia. And he said, well, I don't know. I'll have to check this out. I'll have to get acquainted with this student, et cetera. And so he went to have just to meet the student, and the press got a hold of that and said that he was sponsoring the first black student, and there's a big furor over that, even though he had not even agreed to. He had just barely opening the door. But that was a big thing that was in the press that began to, get the word farther afield. But the thing that really triggered it was the Supreme Court ruling of Brown versus the Board of Education, which said, that all schools must integrate with due speed. Of course, Clarence says, in the South, there is no such thing as due speed. And there is an immediate reaction locally here against integrating the schools. In fact, in the legislature, they said, we will never integrate our schools. And they really did mean it. Sumter County was the last of three counties in the whole state to be integrated in 1970, which is not hardly speedy, considering that was in 1954 that the ruling came down. And I think it was the reason the response was so strong then against Koinonia was that they said, oh my goodness, I mean, these people are living out there. We don't like what they're doing. We kind of think maybe they may be communists because they're living together, And they didn't say they might be Christians, because they're helping each other and living. They probably, in fact, they accused them of being nigger lovers and communists. And I think they thought, oh my goodness, what they're doing out of Koinonia is spreading. Other people are getting sympathetic. This is going to happen, and we're going to lose our way of life, and we have got to get rid of these people. Don't think they ever meant to, really, literally kill them, although they could have. They almost did. But they just wanted to get them out of here so that things can go back to the way they were. So the first thing they thought, well, we'll do it economic. So they put a boycott on Koinonia, and nobody could buy or sell to Koinonia at all in the whole area. Now, you've got a farm. They had as many as 35,000 chickens. They've got a big cattle project. They're planting cotton and peanuts and all. And all of a sudden, you can't buy seed, fertilizer. They couldn't even buy groceries, actually. And so that was really a very hard time. One of the things that really helped was some of the black neighbors who they'd been working together with would go into town and buy groceries, let's say, as if it was for themselves, and then they would bring it over after dark to Koinonia, and the same with fertilizer and feed. So they were able to exist, but they had to cut way back on their farming. And in fact, the story goes that there are 35 chickens. They gave away as many chickens as they possibly could, and then they buried the rest. I don't know. We've never found any chicken bones under the red clay soil, but that's an indication of how severe this was, how difficult it was on the farm. This is when Koinonia developed its mail order business, which they'll have, because they had been raising hogs, so they were selling hams, they were selling chickens and eggs. They had planted pecan trees, and they were beginning to harvest them. And so they started this mail order business, and Clarence says, we'll ship those nuts out of Georgia. And so that's been a fun slogan kind of ever since. So they got that. That was, because it took a while for that to catch on and grow, but that did also help them some with some income. And people, as the word got out that these people were being really very badly treated, and the sympathetic people would send in small amounts of money, never anything much. So the farm was still going well. So then they decided they would blow up the stands where they sold their products. They had two different ones out on highways where there's a lot of traffic, and it was a very good business. They had a large stand with refrigeration and all. They burned one of the stands down, and then when Quinta rebuilt it, they dynamited it. So that was really the main way that they were able to sell to people that were not into the boycott, you know, were not, didn't seem to be affected by the boycott. So that was, that source of selling was gone. Then they would cut holes in the fences and let the hogs out and then chase them all over the county so that they couldn't get them back. They cut down a lot of pecan trees and all of the 200 peach trees that they had planted. Now, I just can't imagine what that would be like to go to bed at night and wonder what in the world you were going to find when you woke up in the morning, that all of these things were gone, that you had, were both depending on it, had done with the sweat of your brow. So very, very difficult, but they hung on. And so that didn't work. So then they decided they would, it was really the KKK and the White Citizens Council that were the ones that were doing this. And they then became violent. And they started coming out to Koinonia at night and shooting into the houses and into the campus. They would come into the campus. Several really frightened, well, just lots of stories, because only one person was ever injured, and that was a minor thing. And they shot right into the houses and right into the volleyball games with kids. The most dramatic one was that three children were sitting on their bed having a bedtime story, and bullets came through the house and between their heads without even touching them and into the wall of the next room. I mean, absolutely amazing. It's like, we have guardian angels that guide bullets, or how could this possibly have been? Because it was so easy for them to have been killed. And at this point, many people had left Koinonia. They just, you had to make this decision. What would you do? You wanted to stay with Clarence and with the whole idea of racial equality and of living the Christian life, but you had a family that you were responsible for. And in fact, Clarence's own family was very critical of the fact that they didn't leave, and urged them over and over again to just leave. And Clarence kept saying, and so did the people who stayed, we haven't done anything wrong. We're just trying to live the teachings of Jesus. Why should we leave? You know, so they were determined to stick it out. But after that incident with the bullets going between the heads of the children, they did a most amazing thing, I think. They wanted to make the campus safe, but they didn't want to send the children away, and they didn't want to leave. So every single night, they would go out on the roadside where the driveway comes in, and they would sit there across the road so that a car could not come in on the driveway. Or they would put a car across the road so they couldn't come in. And so that nobody could come in and shoot, and the children would be safe. And they did that night after night after night. And people would come by and shoot at them. So they wouldn't get killed. I mean, out on the highway under a streetlight's not a great place to murder somebody. But they would shoot into the cars, or they would shoot above their heads. On the night of the, they discovered that on the night of National Guard training, that was the night when they would have a lot of shooting, and till 1 and 2 in the morning. And they found bullets from military guns that would be only issued to the National Guard. So at this point, Clarence wrote to President Eisenhower and said, hey, your soldiers are shooting at perfectly innocent citizens. We need help. Eisenhower just passed it on to his attorney general, who passed it on to the governor of Georgia, and you can imagine what happened to it there. That was the end of that. So they had absolutely no protection in this at all. In fact, you know, the law enforcement and the government and the city and county government actually were in collusion with what I'd call, they were really terrorists. We know them now today as terrorists, yeah. and they really truly were. That kept on for a long, for a number of weeks and months, and extremely exhausting to be trying to figure out how to survive in the daytime and then stand out there to protect yourself at night. But they managed to stay. But apparently a seed and feed store in Americas had secretly been selling to Koinonia. Probably one of the black farmers had come in and bought some, and they knew it was really for Koinonia, but they pretended they didn't know. But when this was found out that what they were selling was going to Koinonia, they dynamited that store totally. I mean, so the citizens of Americas wake up on Sunday morning and there is a huge hole in the main street where there was a feed store. Windows are blown out all over town, and it's like, oh my goodness, this is getting kind of close to home. Now, it was all right if you went out there and shot them, but not here in our town. And so they made a strong plea with the mayor and the Chamber of Commerce, all the main people in the government, to plead with Koinonia to leave. And again, Clarence just said, we haven't done anything wrong. This is our place, God, and we feel like even God gave this to us. And we're just doing Christian service, and no, we're not leaving. And so at that point, I think they just gave up, said, oops, somebody is going to get killed, and then we're going to be in bigger trouble. Just ignore it. Maybe if we ignore him and just harass him a little here and there, you know, why they'll sort of, nobody will pay attention to them, and so they won't have any, at least they won't have any effect on changing our way of life. And so from then on, which was in the latter, which is the early 1958, before, you see, the civil rights movement had really gotten going. I mean, Martin Luther King had started, what, 55 or 56, something like that. And so so it was really before, they were in big trouble before the civil rights movement ever did start for their stand. They would still harass them. They would often not wait on them or do something to their gasoline tank or, you know, something to just make it difficult for them, but pretty much did kind of leave them alone. And so out of all that period of violence, they never, ever retaliated. Now, this is, for us, this is one of the big lessons for us, and I think for the Christian folk and for the country, is that if they had ever retaliated in any way, I don't think Koinonia would have survived, because they would have just kind of wiped them out, or certainly said they had to go. At one point, there's a funny story about a lady that was here, had a nephew who was in the National Guard, and so he came, and he says, I'm going to set up a security perimeter around this farm. And he had his gun, you know, and Clara said, take your gun and leave. And that was the idea. Even if he had shown any possibility of retaliating with violence, it would have probably been the end. It just seemed that Clarence never saw enemies. He said, now these people are, I mean, you got choices about, you know, what you, your values are, what you follow, what decisions you make. These people, they're just kind of making the wrong decisions, you know. They kind of got the wrong idea of this whole Christianity, I think. But he never saw them as being evil people or enemies. And so he was able to deal with them. There are a number of stories of when people came to him or he went to them for something and he treated them with humor, you know, just humor and respect. One of the stories is that he went to buy something in town and the guy in the store said, now, if you'll just write a letter to the newspaper and say that you're wrong and you're going to change your ways and you're going to, you know, be a regular member of this this town, I'll sell you whatever you want. And Clarence said, oh, he said, gee, I just came to buy some seed, not to sell my soul. That kind of, you know, he just knew where he stood and he knew what was behind him, which was basically for him the Sermon on the Mount. And it was pretty clear, and he was very consistent in it, but always in a compassionate, loving kind of a way. So it's a great example even to us today about how we deal with people who disagree with us or who we think are, you know, on the wrong, are doing things that maybe Christians might question. And during the Civil Rights Movement, this was extremely inspiring. Americus was one of the meanest cities in the country, according to Martin Luther King, and a very mean sheriff. And most of the protests were done by young people in the summers of 63, 64, and 65. And they would go out and just be peacefully demonstrating or speaking, and they would be hosed, and dogs, billy clubs, all the things that we saw on TV during the 60s. Very similar in time and activity to Selma, but didn't get that kind of publicity. So I asked one woman recently who had been one of those young people who had, she had gone to jail, she had been beaten, just horrendous things that had been done to her as a 12, 13, 14-year-old. And she said part of it was the inspiration of Koinonia. She said, we knew if we just kept going out long enough and stayed nonviolent, that we, in the end, we would triumph. And so they were willing to go out and put up with that. Meanwhile, I came across a statement the other day from a young man who was in this civil rights movement one summer, the summer of 63, who was arrested and charged with sedition, which is being a traitor. And all he had done was attend a meeting in the church. They charged him with a federal crime because then they could keep him as long as they wanted without a hearing until they said, until this thing blows over. That gave me, I think, a clue into the way they thought that if we just are nasty enough, they'll give up.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And I think that's a tremendous lesson, too, that being nasty to people, sometimes it creates more sympathy and more, you know, more people join their cause because they see how, what victims they have become. And so, so tremendous lessons in history during that very difficult time.
I think we should stop. We'll save it. Yeah. We'll do more because this will be enough for people to chew on for a while. This is like, I was trying to get to this part when I was talking about it, but being so new to all this history, I was unable to like lay it out like you do so well. So thanks for telling us the story.
Oh, you're welcome. I do the tours here at Koinonia, and I just love to do that. Every time we go through it, we have a nice museum that has many pictures. We have a documentary, you know, that tells the whole story called Briars in the Cotton Patch, which is on PBS sometimes, or we have it for sale in our catalog. And every time I just get inspired all over again, each time I recall all those stories in those days. Yeah.
Well, all right. And the website is Koinonia Partners, KOINONIA Partners.org.